Good morning. Gentlemen, while you're getting set up, I'm going to assume that the amici are not going to be arguing or sharing time. Is that correct?
That's correct, John.
That is correct.
Mr. Dunn, you can fire when ready.
Good morning. Jason Dunn on behalf of the Douglas County School District. With me today is Rob Ross, who is general counsel for the district. The question for the court in this case is a straightforward one. Was there substantial evidence in the record to support the ALJ's conclusion that the so-called Hess report was a contribution, as that term is defined in the Colorado Constitution, to some unknown candidates such that the court could find a violation of 145.117? But the case also raises larger and perhaps more important questions regarding the implications of the term contribution for both public entities and individual speakers in the political context. And to be clear, we're under part four of the definition of contribution. Ms. Kime raised for the first time in her answer brief part two of the definition. I would ask the court to disregard that. That was untimely and not raised prior to that context.
Mr. Dunn, let me ask you a question about that. I know you said in your brief that it was untimely, but isn't Ms. Kime allowed to defend the ALJ's decision on any basis?
Your Honor, at trial and both in the ALJ's decision, the ALJ only discussed part four of the definition. The court analyzed to the extent it provided a step-by-step analysis of the definition, which is questionable, but the court clearly only contemplated part four of the definition.
Right, I understand that. However, we have lots of cases that say that an appellee may defend a decision of the district court on any basis, even one never contemplated by the district court. And in this case, I'm assuming that principle would apply to an ALJ decision.
Well, I think the question, Your Honor, is what was the alleged violation? Remember, this was a complaint filed by Ms. Kahn. She had the burden of proving a violation at the hearing and to the ALJ. And the allegation is as Mr. Joyce, who's arguing today, made clear at the hearing, if you listen to the transcript or read the transcript, is that he kept referring to and said clearly, and there was agreement in the courtroom, that we were only operating under part four. So the allegation, the complaint itself, is under part four. It would, I suppose, by analogy in a criminal context, be a matter of a prosecutor charging a person with a certain crime, and then on appeal saying, well, we can also defend the trial court's decision under this other criminal statute.
Well, it seems to me, I mean, maybe the answer to this one is it doesn't seem to me there's anything in the record about part two. I mean, we can
that's
affirm
correct.
On any basis finding its place, you know, support in the record, and maybe that's the easiest answer from your standpoint. I'm not sure there was anything in the record about part two, any factual development and the like. But we can look at that. Let me focus you on the definition here. To me, and I can only speak for myself, it strikes me this case probably turns on what does give indirectly mean? Both of you float different definitions. So, and I guess your definition, if I understood it, imports this concept of receipt and acceptance. And I'm not quite sure where that comes from, so I'd appreciate your addressing
sure.
that. There's nothing in the constitutional definition that deals with receipt and acceptance, and I think Mr. Joyce makes a pretty good point, or maybe I think it's in the Ethics Watch's amicus brief, that tends to, if you have to actually receive and accept it, that may take the word indirectly out of the constitutional definition. So can you address that?
Sure. So as we point out in our brief, I think what Ms. Kime is arguing in this case is that they conflate indirectly promote with indirectly give. And their argument is, well, if a public entity does something that might have the effect or might indirectly promote, the ALJ's definition or interpretation seemed to be that it was anything that might influence an election is a contribution. Let me step back and look at this in the larger context in which the definition of contribution applies, which is, you know, the public entity concept is a very small part of the definition of contribution and how it's used. The U.S. Supreme Court and the Colorado Supreme Court have been very clear that there's a distinct difference between independent political speech and speech that is done in coordination with candidates or given to candidates. And the reason that's why is because the Supreme Court has said, as a matter of First Amendment principles, you can't limit an independent speaker's either the source, meaning individuals or corporations or entities, as to who can engage in political speech, and you can't limit the amount.
Mr. Dunn, let me ask you about that. If you're talking about First Amendment rights, I assume you're not talking about the district's First Amendment rights, because it's not clear, as far as I understand it, that governmental entities have First Amendment rights.
I think that's an open question, and I think there's a footnote in the CCI, the Colorado County brief, that says exactly that.
Well, then that's what I'm trying to clarify. Are you arguing that there is a constitutional right that the district has, or are you making a different point?
I'm making a different point. I'm saying what you do in this case matters significantly for the larger context of how independent speech works in the campaign finance context. So the point I was trying to get to was that the First Amendment protects an individual speaker's ability to engage in independent speech, whether it's an independent expenditure, which is a defined term, or an electioneering communication. It's not a term we use in our brief, but an electioneering communication is simply a communication in a window before the election, 60 days before the general election, that references a candidate. It doesn't have to advocate, it just references. And the courts have said that the governmental entities in campaign finance laws can't limit either by source or amount. And the distinction between those and when a contribution is made is that they're independent and they can't be limited. So if we say here, well, geez, it's given simply by the fact that they disseminated it and published it in an email. And by the way, in the record, there's no evidence that any candidate ever read it, accepted it, knew anything about it, used it, or that any voters even read it. But the key is that if you say in this case that the dissemination of the report can be deemed giving something and deemed a contribution, then you have to say the same thing in the larger context. And so when someone engages in, when they run a TV ad and you see the ads during the political season, and those are disseminated to the public through the TV unbeknownst to the candidate, then that same rule that you adopt here has to apply there, and it would deem that a contribution, assuming the other elements are met, and that would clearly violate the Constitution, the principles outlined by the Supreme Court.
Well, I'd go back to this concept of give indirectly, and I've frankly been thinking about what does that mean in my own mind, and so let me float a definition to you and ask you to respond to it, and I'm going to just tell you it's dictionary definition stuff here. I'll propose this definition. Give indirectly means provide something of value with the intent that the candidate receive or make use of it. What would that fit? Is there something wrong with that definition? It strikes me that would, again, I'm playing devil's advocate here with you a little bit because I'm trying to figure this out myself. It would make play, it would give meaning to the word indirectly, seems to me, as giving means I'm providing something to you of value. My intention, this kind of takes out your concern about independent expenditures. My intention is you're going to use it, or somebody on your behalf is going to use it for your campaign.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because really, I think the focus of the definition is intent. And that was where I actually planned to focus my argument today. And I think if that's the key point in this, and I think the linchpin to the definition is, did the district have the intent to make a contribution? It's not just an intent to put out something that says nice things about the district. It's an intent to actually make a contribution to candidates. And the ALJ really relied on sort of four facts, four things in evidence.
Well, Mr. Dunn, if I may interrupt you, if we're focusing on intent, do you agree that the question of intent is a question of fact?
It is.
And you agree also that the ALJ found that that was the district's intent?
She never said that directly, but I think you have to read that from the opinion, yes.
In paragraph 29 of her opinion, the ALJ said, the ALJ finds that the Hess report was commissioned and published as a means to support for the reform agenda and any candidates who would further that agenda. Is that equivalent to saying that that was the intent of the district?
I think that's probably a fair interpretation of the ALJ's opinion. And I understand that this court has to give deference to the ALJ's finding of fact. But remember, they have to be supported by substantial evidence.
Right, and I understand your position is that there is no substantial evidence to support that finding of fact. Is that correct?
It is.
Okay.
Not that there's not substantial evidence. There's really no evidence. Look at what the court relies on. So they rely first on the contract itself, and I'll try to go quickly. They rely primarily on the contract, just a form contract, but it's the scope of work that's the relevant piece. They had six bullet pointed items that were, I think, negotiated or that the district asked that be included in their report. None of them talk about candidates. None of them talk about the election or politics. There's a lot of weight given to a couple of emails. One that said, "Help us help you." That seemed to be, I think, Ms. Kimes thought that was the smoking gun in this case. But I encourage you to really read Exhibit 15. That's where that comes from. Exhibit 15, if you read it front to back, it's an email string of correspondence between one of the research assistants and the district saying, "Look, we're coming out there from Washington. We're spending 2 days there. We don't want to come with a blank slate," to use their words. "Help us help you. Just help us schedule some things." And if you look at the itinerary that was proposed in there, it's meetings with the public and principals and teachers. Nowhere in there is there any indication that the district's saying, "We want to schedule you with candidates. We want to talk about the election." There's none of that. So if anything, it shows that they didn't have that intent. The report itself, I would really encourage you to if you haven't already, read the report. It's 21 pages, single-spaced, somewhat of a wonkish discussion on a variety of topics from a software and a database that the district has tried to implement for teacher performance.
Well, it's a little more, and I'm sorry, no, I want to interrupt you because you may want to save some time. I mean, it seems to me it's more than a wonkish piece. I mean, this was a puff piece for the district, or at least it's arguable, I'll say it that way. It's a puff piece for the district. But it seems to me your better argument and pushback, if you think I'm getting this wrong, is it could well be a puff piece for the district, but that didn't mean it's a contribution to a candidate.
That's exactly right. I think it's both. I think if you read it, it clearly discusses a variety of topics. If the district was really intent on spending or having others spend $30,000 to help out candidates, would you really do it by burying in a 21-page report a few obscure references to seven board members and hope that people would figure out which two of them were candidates, or mention in the last couple pages that there happens to be an election in November of 2013? As you said, it may have been that the district worked with AEI to talk about topics that it wanted to and come out with a favorable piece, as any public entity would do. We cite to a report that in our brief that the city of Denver put out about Mayor Hancock's first 100 days and how what great leadership he exuded during that time period in the programs he promoted. But sure, that if you put out something that engages the public about the policies and talks about what great work you think you're doing, there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't make it a contribution.
Now, if this was hypothetical, if the report was given directly to the pro-reform candidates, would it be a contribution then, in your view? If reports directly, please feel free to use it, sent that way. Do we have a contribution then?
I don't think so. I guess it depends on the specific facts. I mean, if they didn't give it to the public and they said, "Here's this secret report that we did and you should," I'm trying to figure out how that would happen. But no, I mean, the key is intent. There has to be, I think the Colorado Supreme Court said substantial evidence to support the factual finding of the ALJ. It has to be more than a scintilla. And importantly, they said it has to be more than just raising the suspicion that a fact may be true. It actually has to be direct evidence of an intent on the part of the district. What's interesting about this case also is that, and I want to reserve a little bit of time, Ms. Kime, as we detailed in a footnote, submitted massive CORA requests to the district. The district actually had to assign two employees full time for a week and a half to respond to her CORA, to her open records request. And in that, there is nothing in the record that shows there was any correspondence with AEI about campaigns or candidates. They talk about changes that were made to the report. And yet there's not a single email from the district back to the AEI suggesting any edits. In fact, the only evidence in the record about changes was from Mr. Ross, the general counsel of the district, saying the only changes I was aware of that were suggested were minor to names and dates. That's the only evidence in the record.
Mr. Dunn, I have a grammatical question for you. You said that there must be direct evidence of intent, and Section 4 says that anything of value given directly or indirectly. So how do you have direct evidence of something that may have been given or may not have been given indirectly?
Sure. If you had, for example, testimony that said a person purchased an item and handed it to a third party and said, "I would like you to go drop this off at the campaign headquarters for this candidate," And the testimony showed that he did that with the intention of making a contribution. He passed it through an intermediary indirectly. I think that would be direct evidence of an intent to make a contribution.
Okay, thank you.
I'll reserve my final few seconds in case I have anything pithy to say.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Mr. Joyce.
May it please the court, I am Craig Joyce, attorney registration number 10556. I'm here representing the appellee, Julie Kine. Our state constitution at Article 28 in the preamble contains these words: the interests of the public are best served by strong enforcement of campaign finance requirements. The statute that embodies that same concept, the one that is most at issue in this case, CRS 145.117, the preamble to that act, contains almost identical words. The interests of the public are best served by strong enforcement of the campaign laws. These unequivocal statements of public policy should provide the backdrop and the background for the decision this court makes. All of the tools needed to affirm the ALJ's decision, I think, can be found in four sources. The statute itself, 1-45-117. The definition of contribution, which that statute imports from, our statute imports from the Constitution. The standard of review, expressed quite clearly and fully in the Kaufman case, Kaufman versus Colorado Common Cause. And finally, the holding of the Court of Appeals in the City and County of Broomfield case, which essentially says that the intent of the giver is a question of fact solely within the province of the administrative law judge. The intent, as Judge Taubman noted, is a question of fact. The administrative law judge presided over 2 days of trial testimony. The administrative law judge read two fairly impressively thick binders of exhibits. She made determinations of credibility and weight of the evidence. And under the substantial evidence to support her decision standard of review, this court might look at that same evidence the ALJ looked at and come to a different conclusion. A different trier of fact might come to a different conclusion, but that's not the standard. We look at what decision the ALJ came to, what conclusion she came to, and it's upheld as long as there is evidence to support, or the evidence would support what she found.
Well, let me jump in here if I can, Mr. Joyce. I'm going to ask you to kind of address the same definition that I asked Mr. Dunn to address. I understand intent is a question of fact, and that's part of it. I guess where I'm a little bit stuck is how was this given indirectly to a candidate, and that, of course, turns on what the definition of given directly means. As I understand it, your view kind of cites to us some regulations that I'm not sure that applies, some Secretary of State regulations that talk about really the timing, when
Correct.
A contribution is received, but they assume a contribution.
Correct.
So when is it? So I'm not sure that gets me there. So maybe the best way to start is define for me what give indirectly means.
I believe it's wrapped up with the intent question.
Okay.
I think we can all agree on what give directly means. And we can probably all agree that that did not happen here. The intent then, as determined by the ALJ, leads us to the indirect part. At least that's how I view it. The intent can be found from what I think is a mountain of evidence, what the district thinks is a molehill of evidence, as to what was really going on here. And that is the emails surrounding the creation of the report, the emails surrounding the modifications to it. All of this can be used to help the ALJ come to a decision about intent. the request that the, I think it was the superintendent initially, although it was provided by the president of the board, request for a quote about the importance of the upcoming election to accompany the release of the report. It starts going to intent, the indirect benefit.
Well, let's separate those two things.
The indirect giving, excuse me.
I apologize for interrupting you. Well, let's separate those two things out. So on the first, we're talking about the intent in this email about coming out to visit. And I'll be candid, you don't have to push me too far. I mean, it seems like we're trying to give you what you want. What can we do to help?
Help,
I mean,
that's what
I get that in the email. But that is, you know, totally consistent with we're writing a puff piece to support the district as opposed to supporting a candidate. There's nothing in that email about we want to help these reform candidates.
That's correct.
It's, you know, what message do you want us to give? So I guess I'm still trying to figure out how does that intent get me an intent to somehow benefit a candidate here, which gets to give.
And the context of that, which came out at the hearing, is what I'll address. There is a movement in Douglas County and in many other school districts around the country for promotion of a reform philosophy. There, in this case, was a reform slate of candidates, and there was plenty of evidence about this in the hearing. Reform has a certain connotation. There are certain tenets of that platform of reform. This report, and I do urge all of the panel to read it, talks about the virtues and the successes and the greatness of this reform agenda. There were reform candidates. So the indirect giving occurs when you support a certain slate, when you use public money to support a certain educational philosophy embraced by a specific slate of candidates, that can't help but benefit the candidates.
Mr. Joyce, how is that different from what Mr. Dunn said about Mayor Hancock's report extolling the city of Denver's policies?
Good question, Judge Tolman. Thank you. And again, if we look at the teachings of the Kaufman case, there's a discussion in there about the difference between inform and sway. That might not always be a clear, bright line, but it is a line. There's an area where a government goes away from informing, and Mayor Hancock's piece, first of all, I don't believe it came out right before an election cycle, but Mayor Hancock's piece could, were it tested in a challenge, could be found to be informing, and therefore okay, therefore acceptable. This piece went beyond informing to swaying. Our constitutional system for these types of violations set up that we have an ALJ to call balls and strikes, where you have a gray area, where pitches are on the corner of the plate. Someone has to decide. I'll look at all of the evidence, and that look and determination is to be given some deference. I will decide whether it has crossed the line from inform to sway, and if it's sway, it's a violation.
Didn't the contract in this place, though, contemplate the possibility that the report wouldn't be issued until after the election, sometime in December?
I believe the delivery date specified in the contract said no later than December 31 of that year, which would have been after the election. And if we were only to look at that piece, that one contractual provision, and attempt to discern the intent from that, we probably wouldn't be here. But the fact is, the report did come out right before the election.
Right, but I guess I'm just having a hard time getting my brain around the difference between a report that basically blows the district's own horn or is a puff piece, and then one that's intended to benefit a candidate in the election process. It's just very difficult to understand how you draw that line.
And I appreciate that. Line drawing distinctions are hard, but in this case, the ALJ looked at the totality of the evidence. 2 days of trial, 2 notebooks full of exhibits, language in emails, help us help you, changes made by the district to the report of which there is sufficient evidence. The specific request, and I think one of the more important, it's in Exhibit 16, factual pieces, is the request for a quote about the importance of the upcoming election to accompany the release of the report.
But that was to be in a whole different the online journal. It had nothing to do with the district.
Right. That was to be in, I think, the National Review or something like that. But
so why wouldn't that be, you know, perhaps that's AEI's agenda to promote this. And, you know, Dr. Hess and Mr. Eden are going to go put this in the National Review or whatever they're putting it in. But how does that, I'm still struggling with, where's the benefit of to a candidate here?
It's the benefit is to the slate of candidates who embrace this reform agenda, and everyone in Douglas County at the time knew who they were. At least I think everybody who was informed knew who they were.
Well, I guess my question still is, if the I understand that it's a factual finding, that the issue of intent, but if the ALJ is looking at intent as just simply an indirect benefit, like if the district is trying to promote its own agenda and it indirectly benefits a candidate, and that's what the ALJ thinks qualifies to meet the statutory term, it becomes more of a legal question of statutory interpretation and not so much of a substantial evidence.
All I can say is that the ALJ did look at a whole body of evidence, determined weight, credibility, and came to the conclusion that this was more than just a puff piece with the district blowing its own horn that just coincidentally happened to come out 6 weeks before the election. She found an intent to benefit not candidates by name, and it clearly doesn't have that, you know, vote for or vote against language that would be required in a Buckley v. Vallejo analysis under an independent expenditure, which we don't have here, by the way. The email and the quote that I was discussing with Judge Gabriel, I think, was a key piece in allowing the ALJ to say these two were in league with each other, AEI and the district. And the fact that AEI wanted a quote about the importance of the upcoming election to accompany the release of the report. And even though that quote was not in the document itself, it was in the National Review, whatever, it was some third party publication. That reveals what was going on here. The importance of the upcoming election. If you're just touting your own horn about the successes of your agenda in the district, why did you have to tie it to the upcoming election? Why is the largest single section in the Hess report entitled Electing a Reform Board? And why does the report in so many places talk about the necessity of a unanimous board with no opposition to implement its particular plans and agendas? That's not really describing the agenda. That's an electioneering piece. That is a communication designed to sway voters who might not know really one candidate from another. If they are provided this information about the wonders of this reform agenda and the necessity for electing a reform board, and this piece comes out right before the election, those all can't be coincidences. At least the ALJ didn't think so. I'm sorry.
Well, no problem, Mr. Lewis. I interrupted you. I'm going to float to you the same definition I floated to Mr. Dunn, just to get your feedback. And this is just my own thinking through using dictionary definitions. And I propose to you the definition of give indirectly as provide something of value with the intent that the candidate receive or make use of it. Is there an issue? Push back on that. What do you think of that definition? I mean, one possibility in our opinion here is we may have to define this term, so I'm floating that to you for feedback, I guess.
I don't know that you need to stray too far from the actual definition of contribution in the Constitution, which says anything of value. That's pretty broad. Doesn't require a tangible item, doesn't require writing a check. Anything of value is fairly broad, given directly or indirectly for the purpose of, and I think it's for the purpose of where we get into the intent question.
Well, I'm thinking, I think you may get to intent on what give means, give to a candidate indirectly. I mean, I don't, Buckley versus Vallejo gives an example of an indirect gift as a gift through an intermediary. Mm-hmm. That would make some sense here.
Which would be
the
so Rutt
case, you don't have that, you know, that kind of scenario where, at least in dicta, Chief Justice Bender said, well, it could be a gift when the union is putting up signs. That's what I'm trying to get to, because you talk about if it's available to the candidate to use, and my concern on that would be the district puts this up on their website, and it's pro-district. any candidate could download it and use it. Is that a contribution? That seems pretty far afield to me.
I don't know that you can really separate intent from the definition of contribution.
Okay.
And that's what the ALJ found here. I would caution against importing new requirements into the definition of contribution, i.e. some evidence of a giving, some evidence of a receipt or use by the candidate. That sort of conflates for the intent to benefit with the concept of actual benefit received or effect of benefiting. There's no requirement that we show an effect of benefiting. It's sufficient to show the intent. I see my time is up, unless there are further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Joyce.
Thank you.
Mr. Dunn, you got about 19 seconds just to wow us.
Thank you. I will only make one point. I don't know if I'll wow you, but I will make one point. This inform versus sway standard that Mr. Joyce talked about is first nowhere to be found in case law. But more importantly, that is exactly the kind of nebulous, uncabined standard that the Supreme Court has rejected through Buckley versus Vallejo, and why it came up with its famous footnote 54, where it said you need a clear, bright line so that people know when they're speaking whether they've crossed the line into prohibited activity or their impermissible activity. Because if that line is unclear, then people simply will choose not to speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. We thank you again and Mr. Joyce for your briefs and your excellent arguments today. They were very helpful to the court. The court also would like to thank the Amici for their excellent briefs in this case, which were also helpful to the court. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel, you're excused with the thanks of the court. And once there.